We acknowledge and pay our respects to the Kaurna people, the traditional custodians of the ancestral plains on which this podcast was recorded. We pay our respect to elders past and present, and extend that respect to all First Nations peoples who are listening.
Ecofuturist takes on the challenge of imagining a brighter, greener, cleaner future through conversation and big ideas.
That's what art does. It reports on the condition of being human.
When we're dealing with climate change, there can be a sense of loss. The grief can turn into something positive.
The sense of urgency that society has now is a great thing, but you can only maintain a sense of emergency and crisis for so long.
There's only one way forward now, and that's all of us, you know, to actually sort of stand up and say no.
Get ready to press play on a better tomorrow. This is Ecofuturists. The ocean has captivated us for as long as we've been able to dip our toes into it. We cast nets into it for food. We cross its surface for trade. And we build whole communities along coastlines, just so we can be close to it. Like our land systems, our oceans are critically endangered, facing biodiversity loss, climate change, and pollution. Whilst we love our oceans, we also suffer ocean blindness and assume oceans are infinitely providing, but we rarely look beneath the waves. Technology can help provide the observation platform we need to inspire the public and police this resource. Hi, I'm Professor Andy Lowe, and I'm looking forward to exploring these issues with my guests today, Alan Noble and Professor Sean Connell. So, Alan and Sean, welcome to the show. Sean, let me start with you. You are Professor of Ecology at the University of Adelaide. You published Australia's first textbook on marine ecology. You're an editor of an international journal, Marine Biology, and recipient of numerous national awards for your contributions to ecological science. Alan Noble, you're founder of AusOcean, fellow of the Engineers of Australia, ex-head engineer at Google Australia, and now advisor to a variety of technical, scientific, and innovative bodies and boards across Australia and overseas. Sounds like we have the right people in the room for a conversation about the state of our oceans and about how to come up with some innovative ways to solve some of the problems of our oceans. So maybe we can start off with the first question, which is, what are the problems that our oceans face?
You started with a very big question.
Big question, but you're going to answer it in 10 words or fewer.
I think one of the big problems is in our backyard here, the Great Southern Reef. One of the big papers that came out this year is loss of a third of biodiversity across the reef that extends from above Perth all the way across southern Australia through to New South Wales, including Tasmania.
So loss of biodiversity is one of the major problems facing many ecosystems on Earth, and marine systems are, of course, not immune to that. What's driving that loss of biodiversity?
Could I add to that?
Yeah, sure.
I think
Jump in, Alan. Please, feel free.
What Sean has said is absolutely true, and there's no doubt about the fact, you know, we're facing massive biodiversity loss. I think there's probably a meta problem or an overarching problem that the oceans face, and that's a much more pronounced lack of awareness of marine ecosystems compared to what happens on land. You're a terrestrial ecologist, Sean's a marine ecologist.
And we might go to the beach together.
Well, the thing is, we are a terrestrial species. We live on the surface of the planet, the part of the planet that is not water. And we are much, much more aware of what happens on land. When we, unless you're a marine ecologist or a biologist and, you know, immersing yourself into the ocean, there's just a, I think there's a big lack of awareness of what's happening. I refer to that as ocean blindness. So as a species, we are often quite blind. So that's kind of the problem that almost transcends all the problems. How do we make more people aware of the plight of the oceans? Because until they have that awareness, then it's hard for us to start to tackle some of the specific challenges.
That's right. So it's out of sight, out of mind. And when we come up with solutions, because people don't see it, don't value it, it means when we try to fix it with management options like marine parks, they don't always resonate with the community.
Yeah.
Or they resonate in the wrong way. You know, for example, marine parks, and Sean can talk to this much more than I can, but marine parks are brought in to kind of preserve critical ecosystems. You know, you could say hotspots that are worthy of conservation, high conservation value. But oftentimes, those same areas might overlap with areas that are interested to fishing. And so making sure that we explain, you know, the importance of, you know, marine parks and why they should be no-take zones, it's quite challenging getting those messages across. Yeah. Because a lot of times people just see the negative message, oh, I can't fish here anymore. Mm. Well, that's one very limited way of looking at it. Perhaps by preserving this, you know, we're going to actually have something you can fish in 50 years' time, or your grandkids can fish.
And when we do put in marine protected areas and they work, that is, people don't fish in them, the responses are really quite profound.
Okay. So marine systems, probably we could phrase them as the poor overlooked cousin of terrestrial systems. You know, when we go down to the beach and look out and see a beautiful sunset, we assume all is okay with our marine systems. But when we look beneath the water, we see all is not okay. And we see a similar level of problems that we're experiencing in every other ecosystem on Earth.
Exactly.
And then there might be some knee-jerk responses that come in to protect marine systems. And then you've still got that conflict with other sea use components, such as fishing and various other areas. So it does sound like a complex area to work in, equally complex to terrestrial systems. So we talked a little bit about some of the challenges around loss of biodiversity. What other kind of pressures are we seeing with those marine systems? Before we get on to some of the solutions, what are the other pressures that those systems are facing?
Climate change, heat waves,
yep,
are extraordinarily effective at knocking over these systems. The losses of kelp forests on both coasts, west coast, east coast, the movement of tropical species down. We're sitting on the top of a mountain, really, where there's no place south of us for these species to go. They will be basically moved off. We were talking about marine protected areas. They're one place where we can restore these habitats and make them more resistant to climate change and resilient for them, able to bounce back. It's probably one of the major things next to fishing and water pollution is climate change.
Yeah.
And the term heat wave, of course, Sean's referring to ocean heat waves. Again, on land, we are well accustomed to the concept of a heat wave. I think the term ocean heat wave is probably less than five, at most probably 10 years old. Mm. And I think it just highlights that the oceans, you know, we tend to have this notion that the oceans are vast and, if not infinite, near infinite, and they have infinite carrying capacity. They can carry an infinite amount of carbon dioxide. They can carry an infinite amount of heat. Well, no.
They provide an infinite
amount. No, they cannot. It's fine.
Fishing opportunities, right?
Yeah, infinite fishing too. Yeah,
that's right.
It's just this, we do have this, you know, idealized view of what the oceans can and cannot, well, can do. Mm. And it's simply the oceans are reaching the limits of their carrying capacity, whether it's carrying carbon dioxide, carrying heat, and sustaining fisheries. We're really close to basically hitting or exceeding those limits. Certainly, yeah, sustainably, one could argue we have already exceeded those limits.
So both motivated by the challenges facing our marine systems, you guys have started to work together on a number of different projects. And I think one of the challenges you mentioned was climate change and the lack of habitats that's available for marine species to, you know, settle on and explore, and then kind of new invasive elements coming in. So you're getting a cocktail of quite a few threats and pressures coming together there. So maybe start a little bit, tell us a bit about some of the work that you've been involved in together with Oz Oceans, your organization, Alan, and Sean, also through your work with the Environment Institute at the University of Adelaide. So where did you guys first meet? Maybe let's start there, because I think the human side is always the interesting side. I think, you know, when you get really productive collaborations, it's because people get on, right? And it's because they can communicate in similar ways and they understand each other. So how did you guys first meet?
It was an unusual meeting. I like to say we had architects in common. So we had used the same architect, quite a well-known architect, Max Pritchard. And I guess I was asking Max one day about some of the other interesting houses he'd done. And he mentioned, oh, he's a professor at Adelaide University. He did his holiday house down at Cape Jervis. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And then I... then followed up with an introduction. About this time, so I was at Google. I was about 7 years into my, not longer actually, at Google Australia. But I started thinking about ways in which perhaps technology could be a force for the good of our oceans and the good of our environment more broadly. And so I felt completely uneducated. I didn't know the first thing about marine biology, I mean, literally nothing. So I thought, well, I need to get educated. So I basically reached out to Sean and...
Architects in Common. He could have been a complete nutter, right?
To Sean's credit, he took the call. And I remember as I started to understand a little bit more about how ecologists work, and I'm not just picking on marine ecologists because I'm not sure terrestrial ecologists are that much more sophisticated than they use of technology. But the penny really...
Rulers are pretty sophisticated in
terrestrial
ecology.
Yeah, at least you've moved on from slide rules. But I started to realize that, wow, there's a real opportunity here to take things that I take for granted. Having spent my entire career working in tech, I thought, I think we can dramatically improve outcomes through the, you know, judicious, cost-effective use of technology. So that was the starting point for what, and that was way back in 2014. So 9 years ago. Mm. A few years later, I decided to found OzOcean as a nonprofit. And I asked Sean to join the board as a founding director, and he graciously accepted. And, well, the rest, as they say, is history. That's my side of it. I don't know if you remember your side of it.
So what did you think when Chief Technology Officer from Google Australia rang you up, Sean? That must have been a bit of a surprise conversation.
I was really interested. Anything that's outside my discipline that wants to work with my discipline, doesn't matter if it's a psychologist or an engineer, really opens up doors and fresh thinking, because the science in itself is useless. If it's not being used in some way, then it just sits on academic shelves. I had no idea how to use technology. I'd never exercised my mind to that. But as I was reflecting on my work and speaking to Alan, I started to realize that there was something in this in terms of opening up the public's imagination to what's underwater. And then being able to not only just use that equipment, but actually use it to intervene with nature, to actually restore it. And now looking forward, how we might even be able to change people's behavior to not only accept the wonders of that world, but also accept that the governance of things like marine protected areas could actually make a difference, would be a profound legacy to leave behind.
Mm. So you saw almost immediately some of those opportunities that you started to discuss. And did you start to plan things there and then, or how long did that take?
It took a long time, especially for an academic which has been on these railroads where you have this quite strict scholarship thinking. I had to really broaden my thinking outside that to wonder what could be done that would be effective. You can put a lot of instrumentation out onto the water and it can measure a bunch of things. But for that to actually change human behavior or even marine behavior to bring back these ecosystems really exercised my mind. And I'm extremely excited about where we're going with this now because of the successes we've had.
Yeah. And if you're not making a difference, you know, you might as well go home, right?
So, absolutely.
But that's already a very enlightened view.
Right. It is, isn't it?
Among scientists. Yeah. And
most people in general, I think.
One conversation I really vividly recall, we were talking about the importance of continuous monitoring. And Sean was, as part of my education, I'd played around with these cheap commercial gadgets called trail cams. Just putting out cameras and looking at wildlife on my property. And the technology was pretty basic. You know, you'd put an SD card in the camera, you'd come back a few days or a few weeks later, and then you'd upload to your PC and look at the images. Mm. And then Sean said, well, yeah, except that's kind of hard to do in the ocean. And we do it. We put down, you know, beta stations, and but we only get very, very small observation windows. We don't get to see these systems over many days, many weeks, and many months. So that, to me, was like a real game changer in my thinking, because I could see, well, we know how to do continuous monitoring. It's called surveillance. There's a whole industry. Let's see if we can essentially adapt this effectively surveillance, you know, live streaming technology for a completely different environment. And that was a huge initial focus.
Yeah.
What was really amazing about that is that you were talking about doing it at a cost-effective scale and having many eyes and many ears out in the ocean. And I remember speaking to one of the chief scientists in Australia that was responsible for continuous monitoring. And he has one or two or three buoys worth millions of dollars each. And he was kind of agog thinking that this
boys
could be
being a floating thing in the ocean rather than children.
Yes!
These marine buoys, which have a network and sensors on them that monitor the ocean. And he said, wow. If you can do this for the sorts of costs that you're talking about and have it across a large area of Australia, we'll be out of a job.
And of course, I'm an optimist. I thought we could do things much more quickly. Mm. It's like, sure, we can have this within a few months. Well, guess what? It's taken a lot longer than a few months. And working in the oceans is difficult. It's a tough environment. I like to, when I'm explaining it to my engineers, it's like, well, basically electronics and seawater don't go together very well. Highly corrosive, dangerous. And of course, you've got the physical damage of storms, in some cases, even human activity. So it's been a real learning experience for us to essentially design this low-cost and yet robust technology. It's taken us more years than I anticipated, but I'm happy to say that we have got there in the end. We're building very, very low-cost underwater cameras, low-cost underwater hydrophones, low-cost underwater speakers, temperature sensors. So essentially, OzOcean has been focusing on how we can basically develop and deploy very, very low-cost sensors and a low-cost buoy. We call it the OzOcean rig.
Yeah.
To basically do interesting things.
So inspired by the opportunity to look beneath the waves, use technology to do that, kind of open up the world that divers can see, but most people can't see, and motivated by the harnessing of technology to provide this kind of surveillance monitoring kind of framework. But we all know that kind of getting support for surveillance monitoring is quite difficult in its own right, because you need something to surveil, right? You need something to watch the change with, and that project has to be the motivating piece. So what was the project that you guys decided to work together to bring together technology and ocean rescue?
It was to bring back an extinct ecosystem.
Yeah.
We used to have these oyster reefs that covered hundreds and thousands of hectares across our gulfs.
And across all of southern Australia.
Yes, that's right. That's right. It wasn't just unique to South Australia here in Adelaide.
So from Perth over Victoria to Melbourne and beyond.
Almost as far as Sydney.
Yeah.
As far
that's
as
right.
Sydney.
Yep, up through there and the more sheltered parts of the coast.
Yeah.
These were an amazing resource. They were used not just for food, but for roading. And the bricks and mortar that we have today, you see in the streets around us, those early buildings couldn't have been built without those shell that were moved around and hundreds, thousands of tons of it. Mm. It was so lucrative.
So limestone mortar.
That's it.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. So that was ground up. All those reefs were ground up so we could build.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That concrete.
Right, okay. What a good use for it.
Exactly. It was our economy.
That was sarcasm, by the way.
I'm going to establish a colony and I'm going to grind up all the reefs that will provide food for us. Use it for building.
In fairness, they only ground it up after they completely overexploited and harvested it. And then they ground it up.
Okay. With hindsight, right? Yeah.
And so they left nothing. It was dredged up with these cutters and turned into sand. So you go from a really productive system where you have fish habitat and fish food to something where it's just this desert of sand. Mm. So what we did was we put the boulders back needed for the oysters to settle onto. And my great concern was that we were going to create seaweed reefs. They wouldn't be shellfish reefs. The idea was that we could actually just grow up spat, which is the larvae and hatcheries, and settle them onto shell and scatter the shell out. And that is possible, but it would have taken 20 or 30 years at $300,000 or $400,000 a year to actually get somewhere. Mm. And so I was thinking, well, how do these larvae, the oyster larvae, navigate? They do this sight, sound. It struck me that we're trying to attract them from large distances. The little ones that might be left, we need to have something that will actually give them the navigational cues over hundreds of meters.
So even though the ecosystems were functionally extinct, the larvae from these oysters were still around in the ocean. So still exist in some locations. And then the larvae are really small, I guess, so a few millimetres.
Exactly,
and
tiny
kind of infinitely dispersing around.
Moving around in a soup in the ocean.
Yeah.
We didn't know how much was out in the ocean. They're lost at sea because they've got no navigational cues, which is basically what the old oyster reefs would have had. There would be a sound signature associated with them. So we had to grapple around with what sound signature to play so that they could actually be attracted to those reefs. But without that sound, they're just evicted offshore to die. And it was just remarkable that we were able to work this out in the lab, what sound library to use, and then provide that sound library to OzOcean, who was able to engineer the speakers to do this. The speakers normally cost thousands of dollars, and we just don't have the funds to actually bring back an ecosystem when you're spending that amount of money just on speakers. So, Alan.
So in the lab, you had
racetracks. Kind
of racetracks with oyster larvae.
That's
in,
right.
And you played different sounds.
That's
for
right.
Them. And the one that kind of attracted the oyster spat the most was the winner. And what was that sound? What
it was the kelp forests.
Kelp forests.
That's right. What,
can you do an impression of kelp forests?
It's like bacon crackling on your stove.
Okay.
When you're cooking it for morning breakfast, that crackling noise is the snapping shrimp noise that's associated with the kelp forests.
Mm.
And I suspect over hundreds of thousands, over a millennia, oysters have been able to recognize and evolve to actually go, this is where I need to settle to have a home rather than be lost at sea and die of starvation. So being able to play that oyster, that was absolutely fantastic. We boosted recruitment by about 1,000 times. That's a huge number.
Yeah. So you rang Alan up immediately and goes, boy, have I got a technology project for you. Is that...
pretty much.
Yeah,
he was pretty excited.
Yeah.
And by the way, we should point out, this is the Glenelg Reef, which is a metropolitan Adelaide reef just off the coast here in South Australia, which is the reef where we've had this stupendous success in recruitment. And obviously, we're looking to scale that elsewhere.
So you designed these little speakers to play the snapping shrimp noise.
Yes.
And it has resulted in more recruitment.
Yes.
In the Glenelg
reconstruction
and also in other oyster reefs where you...
Yes. Glenelg was the first time where we deployed our speakers, and that's where we achieved the results that Sean mentioned. Since then, we've deployed in other restoration projects, also here in Metro Adelaide.
So a huge success.
Oh, it's extraordinary.
I was going to add one other point or related point. So I mentioned earlier that OzOcean has developed essentially a quiver of sensors. The sensor that is perhaps the most versatile, an underwater camera, a video camera. And I often refer to it as the Swiss Army pocket knife of sensors because you can do so much with visual data. You can also use it to educate and inform as well. So it really has a community engagement value as well as a scientific value. Obviously, by training underwater cameras on a particular section of underwater reef, we can actually observe the development of that reef over large time spans. So there's much some scientific value in that. But we can also use software techniques, computer vision, machine learning, if you will, to actually do really interesting things. So one of the examples of that is how we're using our underwater video cameras to actually measure water quality or water clarity. It's not quite the same thing as turbidity because turbidity is a particular type of measurement, a particular type of sensor, but it's essentially an alternative measurement of water visibility, water clarity, and it's based entirely on image processing and computer vision. So I'm very excited about that because we don't have to put down a second turbidity sensor. We've already got a sensor. It's called a camera. That camera can be basically doing two things. It can be streaming, continually surveilling the underwater ecosystem, and at the same time making measurements.
Yeah, I can feel the dream of the underwater surveillance monitoring system is started to become a reality, kind of anchored around the oyster reefs, but then potentially reaching out into other systems. So where do you think now the application of technology can go towards marine conservation and marine ecosystem return? So you've delivered something with the oyster reefs. You've trialed and tested a whole range of technologies underwater. What's the next horizon for you guys in this application side?
I'm thinking that it's going to be creating this appreciation by the general public for the Great Southern Reef.
Yeah.
We know that we get the best restoration of our broken ecosystems where people stop fishing and obey the marine park rules. What we need to know is to what extent does that appreciation go with marine park success? And the technology that OzOceans has been developing really gives us a fantastic tool. We can listen to boats arriving, and each boat has its own signature, sound signature, and we can actually see who's leaving boat ramps. When we combine both that sight and sound, we get a picture of how our most cherished parks are being looked after by the general public. And where they're not, obviously, we've got a lot of work to do. Government departments are really cash-strapped. It's a difficult situation for them to be in. So with their resources, how do they allocate them to get the best return on that investment? And if marine parks is the one thing we have over kilometer scales to bring back nature, then this kind of technology would be fantastic to try and bring back nature by making sure those resources are allocated in the best way, which is probably behavioral change by people, which again is appreciating what they've got and looking after it.
So it's a bit of a combination between inspiration, but also policing as well, isn't it? It could be used as a identification.
Well, we're providing tools so that cash-strapped government agencies can be more effective. And that, I think that's true of any technology is inherently a double-edged sword. It can be used to do very, very positive things, inspiring people through underwater video and engendering in people a love of our oceans. But at the same time, it can also be a bit of a stick if necessary. And the same technology can be used to monitor and ensure that these precious ecosystems are properly protected. Hopefully, though, through the former, through the education and the awareness, we start to see some behavioral changes, and there'll be fewer people going out there breaking the rules in the first place. That would be the holy grail.
And most people do it unintentionally. There's no lines on the sea. You can't put a fence around it very easily, and so people are unwittingly fishing in these areas. And we know that from New South Wales, where people are educated and they realise that there are cameras out there which are looking after the sea, that these systems can come back. And in New South Wales, they saw extraordinary good compliance after they put cameras out, and the snapper came back. And the snapper stocks are actually seem to be tracking compliance. And it's small wonder that if you fish, you reduce the number of fish in the sea. If you leave them alone, you get more. So it's not a surprising outcome, but it's amazing. It is in that you appreciate the sea, you have compliance for the rules, and you can bring back these precious resources.
And they can come back quite quickly. Right?
Exactly.
They're quite responsive. So, proof of concept here in and around the waters of Adelaide and South Australia. You've also been able to influence how this type of restoration occurs both across Australia and also potentially globally as well, haven't you? So the work that you've done has been taken up by other authorities.
Well, we're in the process of having those conversations now. OzOcean is engaged with some partners in New South Wales. We're really just embarking upon that. We've taken the very, conservative view. We need to make sure we get it right here in South Australia. Obviously, there's a lot happening here in South Australia, and so we don't wish to scale prematurely. If we start to take on too many different jurisdictions and too many different projects at the same time, there's a chance that we won't do a good job. So, of course, we'd like to do more eventually with other temperate ecosystems in Australia and indeed tropical ecosystems as well. But I think there's something to be said for, starting in our own backyard. And that's, I think, the beauty of being in a place like South Australia. We can connect more easily with other like-minded organizations and make things happen.
So you can start with the oysters and then kelp and then shrimp and then you're restoring
seagrasses.
Real ecosystems.
Yeah,
seagrasses.
And these ecosystems don't occur as sort of monospecific cultures.
No.
The oyster reefs go with seagrasses.
Well, a pine plantation, right?
Exactly, right.
Yeah.
it's really this.
Don't get us going about pine plantations, especially if you talk about Kangaroo Island.
Okay. Maybe we'll leave that for another episode.
When that's scaling that you're talking about going national, international, with OzOceans, we have the blueprints online. People can actually download these.
We do.
So it's kind of open source.
Open source.
Nice.
Barely a week goes by when we don't get an inquiry. Last week, I had an inquiry from the West Indies. I've had Vietnam. I've had Japan. I've obviously had the USA, several inquiries. And it's just that at this point in time, OzOcean can make our tech freely available, but we're not in a position to enter into formal engagement. I think we will, but there's so much to be done here in the South. I think it behooves us to get a few more runs on the board here.
I guess just in terms of marine systems, we are, I think, obsessed with the tropical reef systems.
So yeah.
Great Barrier Reef, Ningaloo. Mm. But the temperate reef systems are also hit well above their kind of weight category in terms of biodiversity metrics.
And economic value. The Great Southern Reef produces over $10 billion of economic activity every year.
Those are the kind of big numbers that I like, Alan. Mm. So, and also, you know, the number of red marine algae, so seaweeds, highest number of species in the world.
That's here, right.
In southern Australia.
Outnumbering corals and coral reefs.
Yeah.
The other thing that's really special about the temperate zone is that if you look at the coral reefs, and you look at fishes, for example, you see the same body plan played out among the different species. So evolutionary, they're quite shallow. But if you look at the body plans and the depth of evolutionary history on the temperate zone, you'll see that there'll be just one body plan occupied by one species. The biodiversity that's represented by time on the Great Southern Reef is extraordinary. If we lose these species, we are losing big time, not just the shallow end of the branches that you see on the coral reefs.
Mm.
And at the risk of stating the obvious, tropical species have the option of migrating towards the poles. Temperate species, there's no place to migrate.
All right. So what are we going to do then? We can build reefs around KI. We can do migration corridors to Tasmania. Where do we go after that? What's say we get to 2 degrees of warming. What happens?
Well, what we're seeing is people experiment with different genotypes where they're trying to figure out which ones are more resistant to increasing temperature and outplant those. It's happening not just with corals, but also with kelps. We might be able to intervene by assisting nature rescue herself by providing the new broodstock, I suppose, for their future.
Yeah. So we talk about assisted migration, where you move species from areas where they're getting heat stressed into areas where they're more suitable. This is kind of assisted adaptation, isn't it? Where you're actually helping select for the best genotypes to weather out the harshest conditions.
Yeah, there is, of course, a limit to that strategy. I mean, there are essentially in the context of Southern Australia, you know, once you move off the continental shelf, you're out of options until you get to Macquarie Island or Heard Island.
There's a massive difference. So, it's not a strategy forever. You know, we still need to limit climate change to current international targets. We can help the species withstand it for that. But if it gets too far, we are going to see broader scale extinction. What about the engagement with people? How do you measure? So, you know, of course, people like to see video. They like to see footage. You know, David Attenborough has always been very popular. But how do you measure just how engaged people are through the kind of work that you're doing?
There's some short-term metrics. Obviously, when we deploy our live streams, we have a number of live streams right now where we basically, during daylight hours, we are essentially shining a spotlight on some very important local marine ecosystems. There's one at Rapid Bay, south of Adelaide. There's one at Edithburg on the other side of the Gulf here. And we obviously measure engagement through, those are both available on YouTube. So we've got the normal kind of social media, YouTube metrics you would expect. And I have to say, they are incredibly impressive. I mean, our users love watching these live streams. I mean, one of the most repeated comments is, I just want this stream to be available everywhere. I want it in my doctor's waiting room. I want it in the supermarket. I'd rather watch this than the nonsense they put on screens. So we got to think about how we can get these live
screensaver
streams. Screensavers. I think there's an opportunity to do more as part of that kind of engagement, user engagement strategy. Longer term, it's interesting that you mentioned David Attenborough, and there's a huge amount of interest in tropical marine ecosystems. I think there's a huge opportunity to basically create more content about the temperate ecosystems and drive greater awareness. And that's a longer term play. It probably requires getting, you know, documentary makers on board. I was particularly interested in a South African doco a couple of years ago called My Octopus Teacher. Firstly, it showed just how intelligent octopuses are, but also it really did shine a spotlight on that temperate marine ecosystem. But that's a very rare, you know, example. Almost probably in excess of 90% of what we see in the media is about tropical ecosystems. So we have to change that. We have to get greater awareness on these temperate ecosystems.
Yeah, I have to balance that out.
And that's an opportunity. It's funny, Elon Musk was quoted the other day, there's a disproportionate amount of the world's talent working on phone apps. And it's actually true. It's the amount of engineering and software development talent that works on another bloody app. Mm. And he was burning, there's so many opportunities in other areas. And he was basically calling out manufacturing. He said, but he said, making physical things is hard. Mm. But guess what? If you don't make physical things, it's hard to interface with the physical world. And I second that because, like, you know, I'd spent my entire career either designing software. Sometimes my software was used to make things. Early in my career, I was in the semiconductor industry. And so I was designing, you know, computer-aided design, computer engineering. But I was always one step removed from the actual physical stuff. Mm. It was the software to help people make physical stuff. Mm. But now we're actually making physical stuff. And it's hard, but it's also very gratifying. Mm. We can make a low-cost camera. We can make a low-cost boy research platform at order of magnitude, not 50% cheaper, you know, one-tenth. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's very, but by just basically completely disrupting and changing the rules. So I don't agree with Elon Musk on most things, but on that, I agree. It's like, yeah, we need more people thinking about, you know, things in the real world. Mm. And this is very much the real world. So I'm excited.
Let me ask you one last big question then. So we've gone on quite a tour in the episode, going through some of the challenges that are faced, some of the solutions that are potentially out there, and also harnessing people's interests as part of that. So last question, hope or wonder?
Can you have hope and wonder?
What can you have hope and wonder? What's the most important motivator for action?
I think it's hope. Hope empowers. We know that pessimism disempowers. People get disenfranchised and they think it's too hard. Whereas hope motivates, gives you some agency over your own actions and is a much more stimulating way to have conversations with other people. So conservation hope is my hope for the future.
Mm, that's your driver.
Yeah, I think hope's really important, but I'm going to go with wonder. If I had, they're very close. I think wonder is how we inspire the next generation and the current generation, but I'm more concerned about making sure we get things right for the future. And through wonder and awe and biophilia, just love of these beautiful ecosystems, I think that's how we can affect long-term changes. We have to be hopeful as well, but I think wonder is what will engender that hope and that excitement and that desire to kind of make a positive change. So I think we need both, but I'm going to lean slightly towards wonder.
So we have a vote for each. Alan and Sean, thank you very much for a really stimulating conversation today and providing some hope and wonder for our marine ecosystems. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alan and Sean are a perfect example of the magic that can happen when you bring together a tech expert with a conservation scientist. You can also get involved with marine conservation. Check out the AusOcean YouTube channel and episode links and notes. And next time you're sitting by the seashore, remember this conversation and think of all the great things happening beneath the surface. This has been another episode of Ecofuturists. We love delving into the big ideas that tie into our environmental future. So if you want to get involved, you can join the conversation on Twitter, leave us a review, or send us an email at environment@adelaide.edu.au. And of course, this season we're supported by the Environment Institute, so you can find out more information there too. We'll pop all these details in the show notes. Otherwise, be sure to follow this podcast and turn your notifications on so you never miss an episode. If you know an ecofuturist who might enjoy this chat, send this episode to them. Until then, I'm Professor Andy Lowe, and I'll see you again next time. This has been Ecofuturists, supported by the Environment Institute at the University of Adelaide.